Malinvestment, not overinvestment, causes booms, by Ludwig von Mises. This article is excerpted from Chapter 18 of Human Action, the Scholar's Edition, and is read by Jeff Riggenbach.
The erroneous belief that the essential feature of the boom is overinvestment and not malinvestment is due to the habit of judging conditions merely according to what is perceptible and tangible. The observer notices only the malinvestments which are visible and fails to recognize that these establishments are malinvestments only because of the fact that other plants, those required for the production of the complementary factors of production and those required for the production of consumers' goods more urgently demanded by the public, are lacking. Technological conditions make it necessary to start an expansion of production by expanding first the size of the plants producing the goods of those orders which are farthest removed from the finished consumer's goods. In order to expand the production of shoes, clothes, motor cars, furniture, houses, one must begin with increasing the production of iron, steel, copper, and other such goods. In employing the supply of R plus P1 plus P2, which would suffice for the production of A plus G1 plus G2, as if it were R plus P1 plus P2 plus P3 plus P4, and would suffice for the production of A plus G1 plus G2 plus G3 plus G4, one must first engage in increasing the output of those products and structures which, for physical reasons, are first required. The whole entrepreneurial class is, as it were, in the position of a master builder whose task it is to erect a building out of a limited supply of building materials. If this man overestimates the quantity of the available supply, he drafts a plan for the execution of which the means at his disposal are not sufficient. He oversizes the groundwork and the foundations, and only discovers later in the progress of the construction that he lacks the material needed for the completion of the structure. It is obvious that our master builder's fault was not over-investment, but an inappropriate employment of the means at his disposal. It is no less erroneous to believe that the events which resulted in the crisis amounted to an undue conversion of circulating capital into fixed capital. The individual entrepreneur, when faced with the credit stringency of the crisis, is right in regretting that he has expended too much for an expansion of his plant and for the purchase of durable equipment. He would have been in a better situation if the funds used for these purposes were still at his disposal for the current conduct of business. However, raw materials, primary commodities, half-finished manufactures, and foodstuffs are not lacking at the turning point at which the upswing turns into the depression. On the contrary, the crisis is precisely characterized by the fact that these goods are offered in such quantities as to make their prices drop sharply. The foregoing statements explain why an expansion in the production facilities and the production of the heavy industries, and in the production of durable producers' goods, is the most conspicuous mark of the boom. The editors of the Financial and Commercial Chronicles were right when, for more than 100 years, they looked upon production figures of these industries, as well as of the construction trades, as an index of business fluctuations. They were only mistaken in referring to an alleged overinvestment. Of course, the boom affects also the consumers' goods industries. They, too, invest more and expand their production capacity. However, the new plants and the new annexes added to the already existing plants are not always those for the products of which the demand of the public is most intense. They may well have agreed with the whole plan aiming at the production of R plus G1 plus G2 plus G3 plus G4. The failure of this oversized plan discloses their inappropriateness. A sharp rise in commodity prices is not always an attending phenomenon of the boom. The increase of the quantity of fiduciary media certainly always has the potential effect of making prices rise. But it may happen that at the same time, forces operating in the opposite direction are strong enough to keep the rise in prices within narrow limits, or even to remove it entirely. The historical period in which the smooth working of the market economy was again and again interrupted through expansionist ventures was an epoch of continuous economic progress. The steady advance in the accumulation of new capital made technological improvement possible. Output per unit of input was increased, and business filled the markets with increasing quantities of cheap goods. If the synchronous increase in the supply of money in the broader sense had been less plentiful than it really was, a tendency toward a drop in the prices of all commodities would have taken effect. As an actual historical event, credit expansion was always embedded in an environment in which powerful factors were counteracting its tendency to raise prices. As a rule, the resultant of the clash of opposite forces was a preponderance of those producing a rise in prices. But there were some exceptional instances, too, in which the upward movement of prices was only slight. The most remarkable example was provided by the American boom of 1926 to 1929. The essential features of a credit expansion are not affected by such a particular constellation of the market data. What induces an entrepreneur to embark upon definite projects is neither high prices nor low prices as such, but a discrepancy between the costs of production, inclusive of interest on the capital required, and the anticipated prices of the products. A lowering of the gross market rate of interest as brought about by credit expansion always has the effect of making some projects appear profitable which did not appear so before. It actuates business to employ R plus P1 plus P2 as if it were R plus P1 plus P2 plus P3 plus P4. It necessarily brings about a structure of investment and production activities which is at variance with the real supply of capital goods and must finally collapse. That sometimes the price changes involved are laid against a background of a general tendency toward a rise in purchasing power, and do not convert this tendency into its manifest opposite, but only into something which may, by and large, be called price stability, modifies merely some accessories of the process. However conditions may be, it is certain that no manipulations of the banks can provide the economic system with capital goods. What is needed for a sound expansion of production is additional capital goods, not money or fiduciary media. The boom is built on the sands of banknotes and deposits. It must collapse. The breakdown appears as soon as the banks become frightened by the accelerated pace of the boom and begin to abstain from further expansion of credit. The boom could continue only as long as the banks were ready to grant freely all those credits which business needed for the execution of its excessive projects, utterly disagreeing with the real state of the supply of factors of production and the valuations of the consumers. These illusory plans, suggested by the falsification of business calculation as brought about by the cheap money policy, can be pushed forward only if new credits can be obtained at gross market rates which are artificially lowered below the height they would reach at an unhampered loan market. It is this margin that gives them the deceptive appearance of profitability. The change in the bank's conduct does not create the crisis. It merely makes visible the havoc spread by the faults which business has committed in the boom period. Neither could the boom last endlessly if the banks were to cling stubbornly to their expansionist policies. Any attempt to substitute additional fiduciary media for non-existing capital goods, namely the quantities P3 and P4, is doomed to failure. If the credit expansion is not stopped in time, the boom turns into the crack-up boom, the flight into real values begins, and the whole monetary system founders. However, as a rule, the banks in the past have not pushed things to extremes. They have become alarmed at a date when the final catastrophe was still far away. One should not fall prey to the illusion that these changes in the credit policies of the banks were caused by the bankers' and the monetary authorities' insight into the unavoidable consequences of a continued credit expansion. What induced the turn in the bank's conduct was certain institutional conditions to be dealt with further below. Among the champions of economics, some private bankers were prominent, in particular the elaboration of the early form of the theory of business fluctuations, the currency theory, was for the most part an achievement of British bankers. But the management of central banks and the conduct of the various governments' monetary policies was, as a rule, entrusted to men who did not find any fault with boundless credit expansion and took offense at every criticism of their expansionist ventures. As soon as the afflux of additional fiduciary media comes to an end, the airy castle of the boom collapses. The entrepreneurs must restrict their activities because they lack the funds for their continuation on the exaggerated scale. Prices drop suddenly because these distressed firms try to obtain cash by throwing inventories on the market dirt cheap. Factories are closed. The continuation of construction projects in progress is halted. Workers are discharged. As, on the one hand, many firms badly need money in order to avoid bankruptcy, and, on the other hand, no firm any longer enjoys confidence, the entrepreneurial component in the gross market rate of interest jumps to an excessive height. Accidental institutional and psychological circumstances generally turn the outbreak of the crisis into a panic. The description of these awful events can be left to the historians. It is not the task of catalactic theory to depict in detail the calamities of panicky days and weeks and to dwell upon their sometimes grotesque aspects. Economics is not interested in what is accidental and conditioned by the individual historical circumstances of each instance. Its aim is, on the contrary, to distinguish what is essential and apodictically necessary from what is merely adventitious. It is not interested in the psychological aspects of the panic, but only in the fact that a credit expansion boom must unavoidably lead to a process which everyday speech calls the depression. It must realize that the depression is in fact the process of readjustment, of putting production activities anew in agreement with the given state of the market data, the available supply of factors of production, the valuations of the consumers, and, particularly also, the state of originary interest as manifested in the public's valuations. These data, however, are no longer identical with those that prevailed on the eve of the expansionist process. A good many things have changed. Forced saving, and, to an even greater extent, regular voluntary saving, may have provided new capital goods, which were not totally squandered through malinvestment and overconsumption as induced by the boom. Changes in the wealth and income of various individuals and groups of individuals have been brought about by the unevenness inherent in every inflationary movement. Apart from any causal relation to the credit expansion, population may have changed with regard to figures and the characteristics of the individuals comprising them. Technological knowledge may have advanced, demand for certain goods may have been altered. The final state, to the establishment of which the market tends, is no longer the same toward which it tended before the disturbances created by the credit expansion. Some of the investments made in the boom period appear, when appraised with the sober judgment of the readjustment period, no longer dimmed by the illusions of the upswing, as absolutely hopeless failures. They must simply be abandoned, because the current means required for their further exploitation cannot be recovered in selling their products. This circulating capital is more urgently needed in other branches of want satisfaction. The proof is that it can be employed in a more profitable way in other fields. Other malinvestments offer somewhat more favorable chances. It is, of course, true that one would not have embarked upon putting capital goods into them if one had correctly calculated. The inconvertible investments made on their behalf are certainly wasted. But, as they are inconvertible, a fait accompli, they present further action with a new problem. If the proceeds which the sale of their products promises are expected to exceed the costs of current operation, it is profitable to carry on. Although the prices which the buying public is prepared to allow for their products are not high enough to make the whole of the inconvertible investment profitable, they are sufficient to make a fraction, however small, of the investment profitable. The rest of the investment must be considered as expenditure without any offset, as capital squandered and lost. If one looks at this outcome from the point of view of the consumers, the result is, of course, the same. The consumers would be better off if the illusions created by the easy money policy had not enticed the entrepreneurs to waste scarce capital goods by investing them for the satisfaction of less urgent needs and withholding them from lines of production in which they would have satisfied more urgent needs. But as things are now, they cannot but put up with what is irrevocable. They must, for the time being, renounce certain amenities which they could have enjoyed if the boom had not engendered malinvestment. But, on the other hand, they can find partial compensation in the fact that some enjoyments are now available to them which would have been beyond their reach if the smooth course of economic activities had not been disturbed by the orgies of the boom. It is slight compensation only, as their demand for those other things which they do not get because of inappropriate employment of capital goods is more intense than their demand for these substitutes, as it were. But it is the only choice left to them as conditions and data are now. The final outcome of the credit expansion is general impoverishment. Some people may have increased their wealth. They did not let their reasoning be obfuscated by the mass hysteria and took advantage in time of the opportunities offered by the mobility of the individual investor. Other individuals and groups of individuals may have been favored, without any initiative of their own, by the mere time lag between the rise in the prices of the goods they sell and those they buy. But the immense majority must foot the bill for the malinvestments and the overconsumption of the boom episode. One must guard oneself against a misinterpretation of this term, impoverishment. It does not mean impoverishment when compared with the conditions that prevailed on the eve of the credit expansion. Whether or not an impoverishment in this sense takes place depends on the particular data of each case. It cannot be predicated apodictically by catalactics. What catalactics has in mind when asserting that impoverishment is an unavoidable outgrowth of credit expansion is impoverishment as compared with the state of affairs which would have developed in the absence of credit expansion and the boom. The characteristic mark of economic history under capitalism is unceasing economic progress, a steady increase in the quantity of capital goods available, and a continuous trend toward an improvement in the general standard of living. The pace of this progress is so rapid that in the course of a boom period it may well outstrip the synchronous losses caused by malinvestment and overconsumption. Then the economic system as a whole is more prosperous at the end of the boom than it was at its very beginning. It appears impoverished only when compared with the potentialities which existed for a still better state of satisfaction.